Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with transplanted, now American novelist Hari Kunzru.
Coming as an outsider, you do see some things that, you know, maybe have become kind of mundane to people who've, you know, who've grown up here all their lives.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Times reporter Charles Duhigg tells us about the power of habit.
You made a decision to do that at some point. You thought hard about it, and then you stopped thinking, but you still do the action.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Hari Kunzru is one of the English language's most acclaimed and inventive younger novelists, we'll call him. His new book is called Gods Without Men. It's reviewed on our cover by Douglas Copeland, who calls it a gorgeous and wise novel. I'm delighted that Hari's here to talk about his book. Welcome.
Thank you.
Congratulations first. Now, let me ask you, you've done something hugely ambitious here. You've actually done something like the romantic poets would do. You've actually written a novel about a place and then examined it from many different points of view over a very long period of time.
Yeah, it's a novel that, yeah, the unity, as you say, comes from this rock formation out in the Mojave Desert. And the action in the book, kind of, a lot of it takes place in the present day, but the spine of present day story, which concerns a New York couple and their four-year-old autistic son, is surrounded by other stories, is surrounded by kind of, and fragments of stories sometimes as well. Kind of, the earliest action in the book is in the 1780s, and there are bits and pieces that take you right through in a kind of stuttering way to the present day. But my idea was very much to make something that wasn't tied together neatly by conventional plotting, but to set up stories which would in some way rhyme with each other or kind of resonate with each other and in some way force the reader into a rather more active participation than maybe in some novels, and that you have to do a fair bit of work to try and see how the threads of these stories actually come together.
And why the desert?
The desert, because it's, to me, it's a sort of visceral place and is a metaphysical place. The title comes from a Balzac short story where an old soldier who served out in the desert in Egypt in Napoleon's campaign in Egypt, he's asked, what is the desert? And he says, it's God without man. And this speaks to me not just about the physical emptiness of the place and that kind of history that the desert has as the place where, you know, you go out into the desert and you have your vision and you come back and try and bring what you've seen back into the world. But there's something very profound about the experience of being, you know, a lonely human in such a place. It forces you back into your own resources. It forces you to think about human agency, meaning, and value. There seems to be something essential about being such a vast emptiness that produces these kind of thoughts.
And as a writer not born in America who's living here now, what associations does the American desert have for you? Is there something particularly – there certainly is something particularly American about the novel.
I mean, this was not a book I intended to write. I actually came to the States to work at the New York Public Library. They have a fellowship program there, and I wanted to use their Asian collection to write something about Mughal India. And I arrived in 2008, and I was kind of basically tripped up by language as much as anything else. Suddenly hearing English as it's spoken here all around me, and being in the midst of America, and in the midst of America at a moment of
now, you'd been
change.
Here before. You'd visited.
I've traveled here a lot. I mean, I've spent a lot of time here over the years. I first came when I was 18. I remember sort of turning up at Port Authority bus terminal, actually,
near the building here.
Yeah, right. In 1988, when it was very, very different from how it is now around here. I've kind of committed to America now. You know, I've become an immigrant to America, and that, of course, is, you know, that's the classical American story. To me, this book is my attempt to sort of place myself in this new context. And I think the desert in particular has a very sort of profound role to play in the American imagination, even if it's often a kind of subconscious or forgotten role. Because, I mean, this, you know, the Great Basin that sort of separates the Sierras from the Midwest was basically the last real barrier to westward expansion. As the country was growing in the 19th century, this was the the physical challenge that people heading westwards had to meet, you know. And there are faint traces of this kind of pioneering activity across the desert. I mean, the most famous example, I suppose, would be the name Joshua Tree. You know, that was the Joshua Tree kind of type of yucca, apparently not a cactus, but was named by Mormon travelers who saw the kind of uplifted arms and felt that that was a symbol that was calling them on to their destiny. And of course, Mormonism, the quintessential American faith, and the history of Mormon religion is very bound up with the harsh landscape of Utah and Nevada, and this kind of bleakness and this kind of harshness of that land produces a kind of sort of extreme self-reliance, and all this seemed to be something I wanted to kind of grasp and understand.
And you've also covered an expansive history. We mentioned very early, since set in the late 18th century, but there are also characters from 1920, from the mid 20th century. How do you decide who you're going to write about?
You know, I did the thing that you're not supposed to do as a novelist, the thing that they kind of teach the kids in writing school never ever to do, which is to not plan. You know, I very early on in this project, you know, it started off as quite a small, I thought, contained project about a couple in a motel in the desert in the Mojave, and it became very quickly apparent that I wanted to try and write about this kind of sense of transcendence and this sort of sense of either sort of a hidden or occulted higher presence that seems to be there in the landscape of the desert. And that brought me very quickly to UFOs, you know, another quintessentially American mythology, and a mythology that has grown up precisely there out in the Mojave through the confluence of a sort of spiritualist tradition and aerospace industry. You know, it's a place where for years they've tested experimental aircraft, and many, many people out there had a pre-existing set of beliefs about how higher powers, and it was kind of maybe inevitable that the two things would come together. So once I had these two things kind of working, I realized that I was in a situation where maybe all the action didn't take place in the present day. It's a funny thing. It is an empty place, and it's a place that you can pass over without feeling very touched by it if you're just kind of driving, you know, driving along the freeway or something. And it seems like there is not much trace of history there. But the more time you spend and the more research you do, you realize that it is as multi-layered a place as almost anywhere. And so, you know, it became apparent that I'd also need to kind of confront the Native American notion of the desert, and especially the coyote mythology, coyote the trickster who kind of connects things that should not be connected, and, you know, gives what's properly belongs to the gods, to man. I mean, I found some stories that were just too good not to put in, really, and I made a rule that if it felt right, I would kind of work with it, and actually I would discover how the different sort of shards of material connected together kind of further along the line.
Now, Hari, we have many young apprentice writers who listen to this podcast. And when you say found the story, what do you mean?
What I mean is you kind of put yourself in the way of stories, either by traveling, which I did a lot of. I mean, just simply renting a car out of L.A. or Vegas or Phoenix and kind of following my nose and talking to people in bars and, you know, talking to people behind the counter in the motel or at the gas station, and also research. So I ended up using the New York Public Library's collection, not for the Asian stuff, but for things like, you know, anthropology and trying to kind of find UFO tracts and, you know, just sort of hunting down anything that sort of seemed like it was beginning to kind of resonate with my material. And, you know, the kind of linking thing being this sort of, how we deal with the unknown. If my kind of high concept pitch for the book would be, it's a book about people dealing with the unknown and with perhaps what is not just unknown but unknowable. It is actually kind of in some way inherently beyond human comprehension.
And doing it in many cases in a time when we think God is dead or religion is not as ordinary a part or assumed part of human consciousness or public life as it once was.
I mean, I identify as an atheist. You know, I don't believe in a personalized creator God to whom I owe an ethical relationship. And however, having said that, you know, that doesn't let you off the hook for any of the big questions about human agency and meaning and value. And in a way, it makes, you know, if you're claiming that you're going to be dealing with these outside any kind of established religious tradition,
it can intensify those questions.
Precisely. You know, I think, you know, you have to confront them very, very directly. And, you know, I think the universal about human life is the fact that, you know, we are finite beings. You know, we die. The world will go on without us. The world will go on after us. And we have to confront the fact of that finitude. And we have to confront what is beyond our understanding, and how you negotiate that, I think, determines a lot of the other choices you make in life. You know, in this novel, the couple that kind of are at the center of it, this terrible and extraordinary and kind of somehow, you know, incomprehensible event takes place, and the husband and the wife deal with it in very different ways. He, you know, he's trained as a scientist, and
this is the couple with the young autistic
boy who goes missing in the desert. You know, and they become the object of a kind of media witch hunt. There's a great suspicion around whether they have had some role in the disappearance of their child. And so they're presented as these sort of terrible villains and have to confront themselves and each other in a way they never have before. And it's, they go in opposite directions. The wife takes a turn towards a kind of overt spirituality and you know, sort of heads into the new age, and the husband goes the other way towards rationality. I mean, I got very interested in this notion, which seems to me, again, appears so fundamental to something in American culture that you can kind of think things into being. You know, it's Mary Baker Eddy. It's all this. You visualize the wealth, you move towards the wealth, you know, and you become the thing that you have imagined. And that's a very powerful story for a lot of people here, and it chimes with the kind of the idea of self-creation, which is, you know, so foundational for America. And this leads a lot of people towards a strange sort of mysticism whereby thoughts have, you know, causality, and, you know, your power to imagine something brings it into being. And if something terrible has happened to you, you've lost your child, are you in some way guilty or responsible for that loss because of your thoughts? And this kind of, you know, it's magical thinking, I call it, you know, in the way that, you know, I think Joan Didion used the phrase.
So have you, in some sense, created yourself as an American novelist now?
Well, I suppose that's one for the readers, really, isn't it? It is a foolish project because, I mean, you know, I don't own these stories in any way. But, I mean, in my defense, I suppose I'd say that coming as an outsider, you do see some things that, you know, maybe have become kind of mundane to people who've, you know, who've grown up here all their lives.
Well, I'll tell you something else, though, that our listeners should know as well, which is you've totally mastered the American idiom in this novel.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. The real thing that knocked me off course for the book I thought I would write was something to do with language, was just actually feeling that the language, as I was hearing it and speaking it, I mean, you can hear that I still have a very noticeably English accent, but I can tell just since things like sentence structure and how I would choose to, there's something that's happened to the way I write as well that's made it more direct, that has made it more, inverted commas, American. And that's fascinating to me, to feel that that hasn't been something I've really tried to make happen. It's just it has happened. It's been a sort of gradual pulling away from how I would have written a sentence when I was living in London to how I seem to write now.
Well, it's happened superbly well. Thanks so much, Hari.
Thank you.
That's Hari Kundru, whose new novel, Gods Without Men, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So the world of ebooks is now kind of looking backward, not just contemporaneously.
It is. What we have now is publishers looking into their backlist and trying to find as many backlist books as they can, older titles that haven't been digitized yet, and releasing them in ebook form, usually to great fanfare. And this week we had two very different announcements by two very different authors whose backlist books are going to be released in ebook.
Now let me stop you for a second, Julie. We have a very smart audience and many of our listeners will know, but quickly explain what a backlist book, yes.
You have new release books, and then you have backlist books. You have classics, you have books that have been published 5, 10, 20 years ago. Those are all considered backlist books.
So if you open a catalog and see the books listed in it, the older classics that a publisher releases or still has in print, maybe in the back of that catalog.
Exactly. And publishers tend to make most of their money off of backlist sales. Some publishers up to 80%, a smaller publisher perhaps. A major publisher may make somewhere between 25 and 40% of their revenues from their backlist titles.
And why is that?
It's because there are some books that are just perennial bestsellers. There are some books that are taught in schools, that are kept in libraries forever, books that people love and books that people will keep turning to. Or let's say you discover a new author, you read State of Wonder by Ann Patchett, and you realize, hey, I really love this writer, and now I'm going to go back and buy Bel Canto and Truth and Beauty and stock up on the backlist.
And for the publisher, it's actually cheaper to publish, because all the big expenses have already been covered. There's no advance to pay and printing costs and paper costs or whatever costs used to be involved in publishing a book. And now it's simply a matter of just reprinting lots of them.
Exactly. Your marketing costs are finished. Your publicity costs are finished. You're not sending the author out on book tour. All of those costs are already finished. So for a publisher, it's a great opportunity financially.
So now we're looking at authors with large, extensive backlists. That means they've just written lots and lots of books that are now going to be converted into ebook form and sold that way?
That's right. You know, publishers are moving very aggressively to, if they don't have the rights to publish those books in ebook format, then they're convincing their authors and those agents to let them buy the rights. And this week, Random House made two separate announcements. The first was that they were going to reissue a lot of John Updike works to mark his birthday this month.
His 80th birthday.
Yes. Right? And they're releasing some of his favorite works, including the Rabbit series. They're also releasing ebook editions of the entire backlist of Mr. Updike's work.
That's a lot of books.
It's a lot. He published 60 books. 59 in his lifetime, one which will appear this summer after, of course, he died in 2009. And they're also releasing a posthumous essay collection, which is called Higher Gossip, that will appear in paperback for the first time.
And who's the other author?
And the other author is Judy Blume.
Also beloved?
Also very beloved, an author who has near universal appeal among middle grade students and even high school students. And she, of course, has many books to her credit. You know, for four decades, I believe, people have been reading these books. And Random House Children's Books said that they're going to release 13 of her older books, which includes some of her most famous books, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, starring Sally J. Friedman as herself, and Blubber, among others. And those are all going to be for sale in ebook, which really changes the way that a lot of readers will encounter these books. I mean, they used to be the kind of books that, you know, you had to kind of steal off of the library shelf when no one was looking and keep it hidden under your bed. And now you can read them in an even more discreet manner if you happen to be an 11-year-old who has a Nook or a Kindle.
Well, do we know, Julie, I realize this question comes entirely from left field. Do we know whether kids that age are now reading on tablets or devices? Do we have any idea?
There are signs that that tablets and e-readers are being adopted by younger readers. 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds are getting e-readers for their birthdays, for Christmas and Hanukkah gifts. And the way that publishers know this is that they, in the last year, they've seen a lot of middle grade and young adult titles start to sell pretty frequently in ebook format. There's also the possibility that people in their 20s and 30s might pick up these books and see how they hold up and download them onto their e-readers.
So they're sort of a trip down nostalgia lane.
Exactly.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Habits, we try to form them, try to break them. There's an important new book. It's on our bestseller list. It's called The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. It's by one of the Times' own investigative reporter, Charles Duhigg. It's reviewed for us by Timothy Wilson, who says The Power of Habit is an entertaining book, but it's also a serious look at the science of habit formation and change. I'm delighted that Charles Duhigg is here to talk about it. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so habit, we're all obsessed with it. There are drug habits, which are bad. There are cool habits, which help us win ball games or whatever. How did you get started on this topic?
So it actually started 8 years ago or 9 years ago when I was a reporter in Baghdad. And I heard about this army major down in Kufa, which is an hour south of Baghdad. He was doing this experiment where his job was to stop riots in the city. And so he came in and he talked to the mayor and he said, can you take all the food vendors out of the plazas? And the mayor, who was dealing with like suicide bombers, was like, sure, I'll do that. And for some reason, that stopped the riots. And the guy figured out, the army major figured out, it was because, and this was his idea, because when the crowd got together, it would take hours for a riot to break out, everyone would get hungry. And if he took away the food vendors, the kebab sellers, they all went home. 9 months without a riot. Previous riots had killed hundreds of people. So I went down to find this guy, and he told me that the military is this huge habit experiment, and I was hooked. From there, I just came back and started learning everything I could.
Okay, so tell us, how do you investigate a topic like this? Our reviewer, who is a professor, says you've read hundreds of scientific papers. You've interviewed people. It seems almost too big a topic to squeeze into a book, but you've done it. So we know how you started. Now, what path do you follow?
So what I knew I wanted to do was tell one or two stories every chapter, right? I like to read narratives. And I wanted to find people who had made these discoveries about the science of habits and tell their story. So one of them, for instance, was a guy, Claude Hopkins, who was a marketer 100 years ago, who helped create America's toothbrushing habit. And one of them was Tony Dungy, a coach who won the Super Bowl.
Peyton Manning's coach.
Exactly. He coaches by studying his players' habits, by giving them new habits. And one of them was actually a woman who just a couple of years ago lost everything in gambling and then sued the casinos and said that they took advantage of her habits and she shouldn't have to bear that cost.
Okay, Charles, how do you decide what constitutes a habit? And what are the range of habits that are out there? In the course of this conversation, I'm probably slave to or exhibiting some habits.
Probably. And we know actually from a study that was done at Duke University that 45% of people's actions on average are habits every day. Now, a habit is, it's not an instinct. A habit is a decision that you made at some point and then stop making. And what we've learned from neurology in the last—
You mean years, stop making but keep doing the
keep
thing.
Keep doing, exactly, right. Backing your car out of the driveway, right? Or grabbing a donut off the counter when you see one without really thinking about it. Or in my case, I used to go get a cookie out of the cafeteria every afternoon. You made a decision to do that at some point. You thought hard about it, and then you stop thinking, but you still do the action.
So is there must be science then that explores this tipping point from the decision to the conditioned reflex or whatever it's become.
Exactly. In fact, in the last 15 years, our understanding of the neurology of habit has been completely transformed. And what we've learned in laboratories like at MIT and at Harvard is that there are three components to every habit. There's a cue, which is a trigger for the behavior, a routine, which is the behavior itself, and then a reward. And within our neurology, that cue and reward is really important. That's how the habit gets set.
Okay, so with the cookie, the cue was the cookie itself?
Actually, the cue was a time of day. What I did is I started taking notes on when I had this cookie urge. And most cues fall into one of five categories. In my case, it was a certain time of day. It always hit between 3:15 and 3:45.
You start to get a little tired at the end of the day. You're reaching that kind of gray zone there. You get sugar fight or whatever.
That's what I thought it was, right? I thought that the reward for this particular habit was eating the cookie and the sugar, the energy it would give me. So I did these experiments at the advice of psychologists. One day I went up and I ate an apple instead of cookie. And the next day I got a coffee. And then one day I went outside the building and I just took a walk around the block. And I took notes on this. And what I figured out was the reason I was having that urge was because I wanted to socialize with other people. I was going up to the cafeteria to talk to colleagues that were up there. The cookie was an excuse. And so once I created this new behavior, once I got up at 3:30 from my desk, looked for someone to go gossip with, gossiped with them, I didn't have the cookie urge anymore. And so I created this new habit. And I've actually lost, I've almost lost 30 pounds since I started reporting this book. But it, a dietitian told me 12 of them were from giving up cookies.
One brief interruption. Memo to Jill Abramson. Duhigg not at desk. Schmoozing with colleagues around the cookie jar. Back to interview here. Okay, now, what about habits that aren't so easy to break? Not that you didn't accomplish a huge thing here, but there are drug habits. I mean, are there habits that we can't control?
We know from laboratory experiments, any habit can be changed, no matter how old you are, how ingrained that behavior is. But you bring up a good point, which is addictions, right? Now, when you talk to addiction specialists, what they'll tell you is most addictions are habit dysfunctions. So let's take smoking, right? Great example. We know from laboratory science that 100 hours after you smoke your last cigarette, you are no longer physically addicted. Once nicotine is out of your bloodstream, you don't have a physical addiction to nicotine anymore. But so why do people who gave up cigarettes 2 weeks ago or 2 years ago still crave one with their morning paper? Because they have a habit, right? They've come to expect when they see a certain cue, like a morning paper or a morning cup of coffee, they've come to expect that reward of the kick that nicotine gives them, that burst of energy. And if you really want to kick that habit, you got to come up with a replacement routine that delivers the same reward. Study after study has shown this.
So what would it be? What's the parallel reward? Let's say you're like an alcoholic or a drug addict. What's the parallel reward?
So the parallel reward, let's take alcoholism because that's a great example. AA. Why does AA work? Because it was invented 70 years ago by guys who had no background in psychology. It's because AA provides an alternative routine. So it used to be if you have a habit dysfunction around alcohol, you have a bad day at work, cue. You come home, you go to the bar, you have a couple drinks, you unload with your friends, routine. And the reward is that feeling of emotional catharsis. I got it off my chest. What AA says is if you have a bad day at work, come home, go to a meeting, talk to your friends, unload all your problems, have that emotional catharsis. The same cue, the same reward, just a different routine.
And so now how do people create like great habits? Like the guy, maybe a little different from you, Charles, who isn't hanging out at the cookie jar, but is like pounding out the copy 12 hours a day. Or I look at my colleagues and they're much more productive than I am. How do they create those habits?
Right. Or they're doing triathlons, right? These guys who exercise effortlessly every day.
So those are habits too?
Those exercise habits are a huge part of how people get stuff done. No one has enough willpower to force themselves to do what amazing things that people do. You got to turn behaviors into habits if they're going to be sustainable. Habits are half of our day. And so your question, how do you create those habits? Well, so exercise is a great one because we know from studies, and there was a big study done on this, here's how you create an exercise habit. First of all, choose a cue, right? You exercise at the same time every day. You put out your shoes and put them on before you have breakfast, something to trigger it. And at the end of your exercise routine, you give yourself a piece of chocolate. You give yourself a reward you genuinely enjoy. Now you're thinking, this doesn't make any sense because the whole reason I'm exercising is to lose weight. 2 weeks, 3 weeks after starting that, you won't eat that chocolate anymore. You won't need it because your brain will have learned that endorphins, endocannabinoids, the natural rewards that come with exercise will drive that habit. But at first, your neurology hasn't learned to enjoy exercise. So you have to trick it by giving it some reward. And actually, one of the largest studies on starting exercise habits that was done in Germany found that a piece of chocolate at the end of that exercise routine is more successful than anything else at creating exercise habits.
Well, let's bring out some chocolate now. Thanks a lot, Charles.
Thank you.
That's Charles Duhigg, whose new book, The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business, is reviewed in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, on the nonfiction side of things, there are three new titles, two of them by New York Times reporters. At number four is a book called The Power of Habit by the Times reporter Charles Duhigg. This was excerpted a few weeks ago in the Times magazine, a big piece about how Target was going after pregnant women by analyzing what they would buy and try to get them to become Target shoppers just at the moment that they were most susceptible to changing their habits. And then the other Times reporter on the list is all the way down at the bottom of the list, number 16, the memoir House of Stone by Anthony Shadid. And he is the Middle East correspondent who died in Syria of an asthma attack last month. Really a great reporter and a great loss for journalism when he died. Probably all the attention on him after his death helped elevate this book onto the bestseller list. Now there's a lot of curiosity about him.
And the book is a memoir.
It is at least his third book, maybe even his fourth. The previous books were all journalism based on his work in the Middle East. He'd reported in Iraq and Afghanistan and then on the Arab uprising.
And not only for the Times. In fact, he became really famous as a correspondent when he was at the Washington Post.
That's right. He was 42 years old, I think, when he died, and 43 years old, and he had already won two Pulitzers in his career. The first of them was for the Washington Post. The second was here at the Times. I think he also worked for a brief time after he left the Washington Post at the AP before he came to the Times. He had a long, distinguished career, died far too young, and was very good at kind of getting under the surface of the story to get kind of human details. And it did a lot of taking you into people's houses and really showing you what it was like to live in a certain society that was very foreign to Americans.
And I believe he taught himself Arabic at a fairly advanced age. It's not as if he grew up speaking it.
Right. What this memoir talks about is he is the son of Lebanese-American parents. He grew up in Montana or it was somewhere out west. And it wasn't until he was in college that he became really curious about his family background. When he decided to go into journalism, he really decided, I want to go and report about what it's like for people living in the Middle East. I want to track down my family's history. This book is about going to find the house that his great-grandfather had built in Lebanon. It's a stone house, and it was in ruins when he found it. And he gradually rebuilt it and tells the story of rebuilding it. And as he's telling that, he's also telling his family history and the history of that society and his own life. Then the third book on the nonfiction list is not by a New York Times reporter. It's by a former partner at Goldman Sachs. It's kind of this wonky politics prescription called Becoming China's Bitch. And despite the title, it's not just about China. It's the subtitle is something like it and nine other potential catastrophes or and how to avoid them. It's something like that. The guy's name is Peter Kiernan. He is kind of this centrist libertarian guy who explains his thoughts on policy and politics. It almost reads like a campaign book, but he swears he's not running for office. He originally wanted to call the book The Radical Center, and
but that title was taken.
His publisher nixed that, and then he wanted to call it The Way Forward, and they nixed that too. So he called it Becoming China's Bitch, and next thing you know, it's at number 5 on the bestseller list.
And what about fiction?
Over on the fiction side, there are 4 new titles. 3 of them are mystery series. At number 15 is Trail of the Spellmans. It's the 5th title in a comic mystery series by Lisa Lutz. At number 7 is Cinnamon Roll Murder by Joanne Fluke, no relation to Sandra Fluke of Rush Limbaugh fame recently. Joanne Fluke writes these recipe mysteries.
They're murder mysteries with recipes in them.
That's
but not
right.
For recipes for killing people.
No. She gives baking recipes in them. At number 2 is Jonathan Kellerman's new Alex Delaware mystery, Victims. And then at the top of the list, it's not a mystery or a series. It's Jodi Picoult's new book, Lone Wolf, debuts at number 1. That's about a man who's comatose and his family is trying to decide whether to pull the plug or not.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.